everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Hooked on Hitchcock, where we dive deep into the realm of like movies that Hitchcock has made that not a lot of people have really even seen or heard of. Some, or we try. This one's a little bit, it's not as popular, so we can't wait to discuss it, but it's apparently one of Hitchcock's favorites. You know, I'm sure he is a lot. So here we go. My co-host G. Larry Butler. How you doing, G. Larry?
It's great, Jonathan. It's good to be back.
It's great to be back. I'm excited. This is going to be fun. And then we've also got our special guest here, Mark DiValenti. How you doing, Mark?
I am fantastic, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
All right. We're happy to have you here. And we're going to be talking about the, 1970 something or 60 something? It's got to be 60.
There's a bunch of Roman numerals in the title, so whatever you want to translate there, Jonathan, works out.
Oh, okay. Because yes. I don't really know Roman. 1955. I thought it was 60, but because it's color, you know, but, you know, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like colorized. It was, you know, beautifully shot in color.
Technicolor, right?
Vista something.
Jonathan, before we begin, maybe we should introduce Mark. Mark, I have a question. Welcome aboard. I have a question for you. Who is Mark DiValenti?
Wow. I'm not prepared to answer any open-ended questions from anybody this evening, Larry, but I appreciate you asking that question. So, yes. My 20-second response is somebody who likes to ask other people questions and doesn't like to answer themselves. So I appreciate that. Touche, sir.
Touche. So anyway, we love your show. Mark does brain burrow and digging deeper, and it's amazing. Some of the answers are just beyond belief. So welcome aboard.
Well, it's because it's not scripted, you know, like they don't get a, you know, you don't probably send them the questions beforehand, right?
Oh my gosh, no, absolutely not.
So that makes it more fun for a podcast if you have no idea what the next person is going to say, you know, and they have to think about it because I've listened to your show enough and I'm like, oh, God, like when you ask these questions, they're like, that's I never thought about that. Oh, my God. But
the question,
as we've said this, whenever I talk to Mark on the phone, like it becomes like a therapy session. It's like he can't turn his work off, you know?
I want to lay down on the sofa every time I talk to him.
So you're setting a precedent for this evening then as far as a therapy session regarding this Hitchcock film. So we'll see how it goes.
Yes, I can't wait.
You could add another dimension, Mark, for sure.
Well, I think actually this is kind of the perfect movie for that.
Yeah.
Because Trouble with Harry is a sort of a, I don't know, like, I want to say it's kind of a really fucked up movie. I'm not going to lie. Like there's problems with like, I mean, not problems like with the movie itself, but like, you know, the fact that the story goes that there's this guy, Harry, that the captain, what was his name? Captain,
Wiles.
Captain Wiles. Discovers, that he thought he shot, you know? And so he's like worried more about jail than anything else, like going to jail and stuff like normally you would be, you know, if you thought you had
accidental, but still he was worried about it. So
he thought it was an accidental. And then it turns out it wasn't even that, like even at the end, spoiler alert, by the way, if you haven't seen Trouble with Harry, I don't know why you're listening to our podcast, where we're reviewing it or talking about it, but, the ending of the movie basically points out the fact that, you know, nobody really caused his actual death. His actual death was, regular, God, what is it?
Heart attack.
Yeah. Was it a heart attack or?
Due to stress. So indirectly it was caused by two women. We won't name them, but, well, maybe we will later, but they both hit him in the head. So I'm sure stress contributed. He might have died anyway, but he was not a well man.
Apparently not. We never got to really meet we never really even got to see Harry at all. We got to see his feet, you know, which.
That's a very interesting point. You know, later they tried to do some other footage he was not available, the actor. So you notice they didn't show the head, just the feet sticking out. They couldn't get a stand-in or a lay-in, whatever, because he was laying down.
Right. Well, Larry, that's a really good point. And I wondered when they showed those scenes. And personally, you know, I've not acted as much as both of you, but like I've struggled with playing a dead body on screen, like holding my breath, like being quiet. And I thought, did they do that just to kind of obfuscate the face? Because it was hard to keep that still. But it sounds like it was actually more than that. It sounds like it wasn't the same person, Larry, based on what you're saying.
And you notice in the sketch, he looked like Vincent Price.
Yeah, good point.
It's like, that's Vincent Price. So that was kind of an inside joke, probably. But
maybe. Interesting. I don't know. How popular was he at that time? Because I know, like...
Oh, tons.
Yeah, well, I guess he had done... He had never worked with Hitchcock, though. Like, that's kind of a weird thing to me, I guess. Maybe...
Hitchcock worked with him later on Hitchcock Tonight or whatever the show was. You know,
is he on a show?
Yeah, I just
the Alfred Hitchcock Presents or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's right. I just watched it last night. I have one of the screeners.
Wow. So he was on. I did not know he was on.
I didn't know that either.
I know Peter Lorre was and a couple other big name actors, but I didn't know Vincent Price. I need to watch that episode, you know, just because I mean, I absolutely love Alfred Hitchcock Presents is probably one of my favorite anthology film or series, you know, just because it's so much fun. It's not, you know, like each short is just fun, you know, like,
sure.
You know, even if it's about murder, you know.
It's more fun than the movie that you watched right afterward or the short film. He'd always do something that ties in with the storyline, but he was so gifted at just improv, or it was probably scripted, but he really was a master at that stuff and making fun of himself and he, you know, satire and the irony of it all. And good evening. And then he'd go into this little bit that he did. And it was laughable.
Well, an interesting thing is that, you know, I've read this thing about Trouble with Harry that a lot of the actors were like no name actors at the time. I think a lot of them became more famous later, not just because of this movie, but because of other things like John Forsythe. But Edmund Gwynn, who I think, Larry, you've talked about him before, because didn't you say that people had said you look like him or something?
No, like, that was Peter Travers from.
Oh, that's right.
You know, the thing about he jumped in the river, and then the other guy had to save him. What was the name of that?
Oh, It's a Wonderful Life.
A Wonderful Life, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Clarence, the angel, right, in that movie.
Yeah, that's what I look like.
Wow.
Now, Edmund Gwynn, nobody, unless you're an historian, nobody knows that. But Edmund Gwynn, wasn't he the Santa?
He was Santa in Miracle of 34th Street, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he was actually in the World of Oz or whatever it was, Wonderful World of Oz. Wasn't he?
Lion,
or was that somebody else? Gwynn?
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I think I know what you're saying. I think there was maybe it was another actor with a similar name. Let me look that up real quick. You said he was the Tin Man, or?
No, I think he was the Lion.
The Lion.
I thought it was him, but it could be wrong. But I couldn't find a reference to that.
No, it was Burt Lahr was the Cowardly Lion.
Okay, totally wrong.
No, it's okay. It happens.
Gary Mathers, though, it was his first time, and Shirley Klein were both making their debut. And Jerry became famous a couple years later.
So he became famous for Leave It to Beaver, if I'm correct. And Shirley MacLaine is Shirley MacLaine.
Well, it's interesting because with Jerry Mathers on there, right, which I did not remember him being in that, and some of his conversation, he said things like gee whiz and things like that, and I wondered how much of it was ad-libbing, because obviously those types of phrases came out later in the Leave It to Beaver show, so I wonder how much of it was allowed for him to just sort of ad-lib at that moment.
Right.
As they permit that, if it sounds good.
He was like one of my favorite characters in the movie, though, because I loved how, like, he was such a sweet kid. But he was like a kid, like he was like this just precocious little boy who would go around and, you know, be like, Yeah, one of my favorite lines in the thing is they're talking to the man in the McGuinn's character, and they're talking and Captain Wiles and his lady, and he's like, you know, basically selling him the rabbit or whatever he shot and stuff, and he says, you know, here you go. And then she's like, here's a blueberry muffin for you. And he's like, I think it's worth blueberry muffins.
Right. Yeah.
I just thought that was so cute. It was so funny.
Right. So I loved how it opened, you know, where he was hunting through the forest and, you know, got a great scenery in that. And then how he discovered the body and ran home to tell his mother. And she comes back and says, I'm glad he's dead.
Right.
Like, that, wow, what is this?
That's where the movie like starts off. Like, everybody is so nonchalant about this dead body.
Yes, that's the whole bit. You know, I summed it up by saying, you know, there's no respect for the dead.
People
tripping over him, kicking him several times, and jumping over him and just disregarding him in every manner, dragging him around, burying him.
Burying him like 10 times. I mean,
that's right.
Burying him, unburying him, burying him again. Like, that poor guy. Oh, the dead body. And then they leave him at the end. So, like, basically, if you think about it, it takes place mainly all in one day until the end of the movie. And then, you know, at the end of the movie, he's back where he started, pretty much. So, like, from the beginning of the movie all the way to the end. Like, you know, it's like, I love that line at the end. The trouble with Harry is over.
That's right.
Because there's no more trouble with him, I guess. Everybody, you know.
People were annoyed with him, actually, you know, because you're an inconvenience. I mean, you're causing me problems. I mean, I might be implicated in something. And it was so, and I want to know Mark's take on this, because, you know, the psychological take. As to why people would do things, you know, they feel guilty, so they bury them, and then they unbury them because they feel equally guilty in a different respect. Is self-interest involved in some of them? It must be, but I was wondering about what you thought about all of
that. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing, Larry, and I'm glad you called that out. Oftentimes, and I can't help it, when I watch films, I can't help but think about how people communicate, how people respond, how people are tying into their motivations, and it's hard to assess in movies, right? Because it's not real. So, like, in my experience, whenever I've acted as patients, you know, whenever I'm in lots of trainings I've done, right, which is like I'm acting as a patient who's struggling with drinking, right? It's like I'm trying to build that motivation into my brain, but it's not my real motivation. So it's like there's always that sort of part of a movie where I'm thinking this isn't the real person's motivation, so they can't really dig deep, you know.
Uh-huh.
But that being said, I think I kind of looked at this movie as what it was, which was these aren't really actually how people probably would react in real life, you know? And I think that was the interesting part, which I really liked at this movie. I think as long as you can accept it for what it is, whereas you said, people were irritated. People were looking at, and again, even looking at like even just the main characters and how within one day he was proposing, right? With Marlo was his name, right? The artist, yeah. Like, so I'm like, all right, I can take this for what it is. Within one day of meeting Shirley MacLaine's character, John Forsythe is proposing. So,
No. That is a Hitchcock trope. We have seen that. We've seen that in countless movies. Suspicion, you know, basically he's like asked her to marry him and like one day of meeting him you know, whatever.
Right.
Rebecca, there's a ton of movies. And I see that, and it always baffles me. I'm like, is that what Hitchcock did with his wife? Like, you met her, and he like married her like quickly, because like that is a constant thing. I mean, the only thing we missed in this that's not a trope of Hitchcock is there was no train. I don't think they even talked about a train.
Well, Hitchcock was very British, and you know, British are notorious for that. They're very have Victorian morals. And I read about him that he was platonic with his wife, and he was kind of a voyeur. He had holes drilled in the wall of his actress's dressing rooms, and And so he got off sexually that way. And he married his wife. I guess they had a child together, but after that, he never had sex with her again. And what I wanted to bring up was that Sam wants to marry Jennifer, and so he buries Harry to protect her because he thinks she's guilty of his death. Then he unburies him because she can't marry him if there's no proof of his death.
So it's
complications and you know all these different things that the contradiction, I guess. So the whole thing is fraught with that.
Go ahead, Mark.
No, I think I agree with you. I agree with you totally on that. I think it was just an, but again, I think if you take it for what it was, I think in looking at these interactions, and it's just, it's, and again, you talk about tropes, right? It's always a Hitchcock trope about the lovers and all the violence that occurs. And I feel like there's always this constant, you know, meshing of like relationships and all the, you know, the crazy violence, whether it's psycho or anything else that's occurring. So it's interesting.
I agree. And what I was going to say is just like, you know, as you said, Mark, it's sort of a fantasy, you know, it's sort of his idea. And I absolutely love the scene with Shirley MacLaine explaining to the doctor everything. She's like recapping the whole movie, you know, and she says it so sweetly. She reminded me a lot of like old school Patricia Arquette when you used to watch, you know, I mean, I guess Patricia Arquette reminds me of, you know, of Shirley MacLaine. But, you know, whenever I watch her, I was like, she reminds me of someone. I can't figure out who. But if you ever watch True Romance, Quentin Tarantino's movie with Patricia Arquette, she sounds and acts just like Shirley MacLaine in this, where she's just sort of this sweet kind of like, you know, down to earth. I don't know, just her voice, everything, her mannerisms. I doubt it that she's seen this movie and that she like kind of based that character a little bit like that, but I wouldn't be totally surprised because it does come off sort of that way in a way. I don't know. But yeah, she was so that just the whole scene where she's like, oh yeah, he found him, but then we discovered him, and then she discovered him, and then he did this, and then they did this, and they buried him. Oh, but then he brought him back so that we could get married, you know, right? And I'm just, and the doctor's right. Just looking at them going, what the hell did I just walk into?
Right.
Oh, by the way, that doctor is the most worst doctor ever. Like he's walking, he like trips over him twice.
Yeah.
Not even once. Like, did he do like a loop or something? Because he came back and tripped over him again. And then this
acknowledges the body until later in the movie.
Yeah, later on, and then he's like, oh, I'm sorry for disturbing you. And then just keeps walking. And one of the guys was even like, I hope I don't ever get, you know, called into his office.
Right. I don't want to get operated on by that
guy. Yeah, he doesn't even realize somebody's dead. You know,
well, and I think that's a good point, right? About like this movie, you just have to have that suspension of disbelief and know in this world of this Hitchcock movie, people are going to act like that. You know, people are going to, at the very end, especially, they're essentially anticipating young Jerry Mathers coming across this decomposing dead body and going back and telling the mom. Like, it's like expected as part of it. I think as long as you can suspend that disbelief, I think you can really enjoy the movie, you know?
Exactly. So the main reason that Larry and I started this podcast before was because Larry had done these other shows, other reviews for us, where unfortunately he was not he wasn't happy giving bad reviews of movies, you know, or he wanted to watch good movies. He didn't want to watch bad movies and have to give bad reviews, you know, or whatever. So he was you know, more thrilled to be able to give, you know, his, you know, review of something that's actually pretty damn good. And honestly, like, I forgot how good this movie was. You know, this movie had some amazing scenes. They were really funny. What was everybody's favorite scene? I'll tell you mine first and tell you guys what you guys thought. But my favorite scene is the scene where they get the millionaire who's going to give the guy all the money for all, or give money for all the paintings. And then instead of like asking for, you know, $1 million or whatever, you know, for everything, he starts doing stuff for everybody else. You know, the kid too, you know, what would Arnie like? You know, what would Artie or whatever like? What would, you know, you like? What would you like? What would you like? And then they're like, well, you got to get something for himself. And then he whispers it. And the whole time I'm like, is this going to be the MacGuffin? Is this going to be like a thing where we don't really know what the answer, what he says? And then, of course, we find out it was double bed, which I thought was funny, you know, which she said it was practical. I thought that was kind of funny. But what did you guys, what was your guys' favorite scene? I guess Mark first.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. So I think I had a couple, I had two favorite scenes, actually. One was whenever, and again, I can't remember their names, like Marlo and the captain, right? We're first conversing on what to do with this body. I just think just the whole, them out there, and it was very just a nonchalant conversation about it. And they were kind of going back and forth. And I just really appreciated that dialogue. Mm-hmm. I also thought that later on, much later in the movie, and I can't remember the, you know, the sheriff's name, right? But Dano was his last name, of course, the actress. Oh,
Calvin Wiggs.
Yes, Wiggs, right, right, Wiggs. And they were just going back and forth about how he's saying, like, I didn't go to some fancy art school, but I just thought that whole dialogue there and just him, like, just trans, you know, changing the I just really appreciated that dialogue between the two of them. And I thought that Wiggs, you know, obviously the actor that plays him, and I've seen him in many other things, I just really appreciated that dialogue. I'm a huge fan of dialogue in movies, and I think both those scenes for me really stood out.
Well, I agree, because, my favorite scene is where they want to give him a distraction, get him like out of there, you know, so that they can just get his whatever. Cause you know, people always wonder like, where's the Hitchcock suspense in this movie? It was that scene was the suspenseful scene. It was like, are they going to get caught? Or are they not going to get caught? And then the guy honks the horn. That's and everything, and the guy just freaks out, like, who's honking my horn? What's going on? He runs out and he starts yelling at the guy, like, you'll never be able to afford this car.
That's right.
You know, it was a nice car, I'm not gonna lie. I always like those old, have an affinity for those like old school cars, you know, and everything. Right. Larry, what is your favorite scene in this movie?
There were several, but I don't know, throughout the movie there was little bits and pieces. This kind of ties in with the appearance of Hitchcock, and I don't know if you guys noticed him, but
I didn't.
I have to admit, I missed him, and I read somewhere this obscure source, and it told. It was like 22 minutes in. You remember where the rich guy pulls up in the limo, and he's looking at the artwork, and Sam comes out, and he grabs something and goes back in the house, just totally ignores the man. And I'm thinking, what an idiot. He wants to buy his paintings. And he went for a pencil or something. And Hitchcock was across the street walking by. They said, if you blinked, you missed him. There's 2 seconds. But, I mean, that was one of them. But I have some great lines I wanted to repeat real quick. Remember when Mrs. Wiggs was talking to Sam? And he said, well, how were you referring to me when you were talking? She said, your name came up when we were discussing strange people. And it's like that. And then also when Sam said, Sam was talking to the captain about possibly dating Mrs. Wigg. And he said, well, she is well preserved. Preserves have to be open someday. So there were a lot of sexual innuendos here. Across her threshold. And I caught that. And somewhere else had mentioned all the innuendos. Some were outright outrageous, like when Sam first meets Jennifer, he says, I want to paint you nude. Ever talk right. That frankly before.
I was surprised, like that shocked me, like
boundaries by doing that.
This would definitely not be made. Well, I don't know, I think you could still, I'm sure somebody would still say that. It was just not maybe go over as well with the other, with the girl, you know. But you know, like she was like all flirting back with him and everything. It was pretty.
Yeah. And then when a captain said, police use psychological techniques. I was thinking of Mark here. They wear you down until you're almost grateful to get into the gas chamber.
That's right. That's right.
That's true, too. They really do. You know, I've been interrogating, but.
Well, that goes back to our discussion before, Larry, like on the last couple episodes or whatever. We always kind of bring this up, but Hitchcock does not like the police. You know, he never, as a young boy, he was terrified of them. You know, his like mother made him, had him arrested as a, you know, punishment for him or whatever once. And after that, he's sort of never liked the police. So, anytime you ever see, the police in his, you know, in his movies, it's always in a negative light. You know, there's never a cop as like a lead actor or anything, a lead character. You know, it's always like sort of a villainish kind of thing. And Weeks or Wiggs? How do you say his name?
He called her Wiggy, remember?
Okay, so it was Wiggs, I guess.
Yeah.
Because that was the cop, right? So it was Miss Wiggs and
was the cop, the deputy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So. Deputy Sheriff Calvin Wiggs. So he's sort of like the villain in this movie, you know, like
they made him a simpleton, kind of a foolish guy, and even says that you made a fool out of me. But he looks a lot like the guy in Beverly Hillbillies. Did he go on to do that, or was that somebody else?
Oh, Buddy Epson.
Yeah, he looks a lot like him.
He does, actually. You're right. But yeah, he wasn't the same guy. Okay. But yeah, there's a similar look to him. I agree with you.
So my question was, why did he did he not know that the body was in the tub was like switched around? Because at the one point he's like trying to keep the door shut, you know? And I'm like thinking, why is he doing that when there's nothing in there? You know, like he's making himself look suspicious.
The body was in there, but, that was another of my favorite scenes where, you know, they shut the door real quick and pretended that it was a frog. The kid was bathing the frog.
Oh, no. Well, no, right, that was in
the closet, Jonathan.
I'm talking about the closet. Right. There was the closet kept opening up, right? And everything. And so I was, why, you know, what's his name? Marlowe. Marlowe's the whole time is like holding the door so that it won't open up. Yeah. And then at one point, he like, because the cop keeps kind of coming near him and everything, and I'm like, if the guy's not, the dead body is not in the closet anymore, it's in the tub, you know, or whatever, why is he like freaking out about that? Like, I don't think, like, it confused me, because the door opens up or whatever, when it opens up, then, you know, it would just be, the cop would just see it and be like, okay, I don't know. You got to get that door fixed. You know, like there's nothing bad.
That's a good call out, right? I think, you know, in the film, it was about the drying rack that they had out, right? But again, like the cop was not going to make that a connection or anything like that. So that's a really good point. It was kind of anticlimactic.
Right.
For that reason. I agree.
So it just felt weird to me. Like it just felt fair. Strange. But, you know, but then, and then he was like, you know, the little kid was like, what's he doing in the tub? And they're like, oh, it's the frog. That's where frogs, you know, are supposed to be. And I'm like, good call. Because like, that was quick, you know, like, and the kid didn't even like question it. Like that's not a frog in the, you know, cause he was talking about the body. He wasn't talking about the frog. So I'm surprised that kid didn't say, you know, like, you know, but obviously if he did, they would have been caught in trouble or whatever, and they would have found the body.
Well, and I think that's a good point, right? I know they made the reference to, dang it, what's his name? What's Jerry Mather's character's name?
Artie?
Yes. Something like right? That. Like earlier he was making the comments about confusing yesterday and today and everything, and they tied that in later. I wish they would have made more of that as part of the conversation. Like they had one throwaway line earlier in the film about him confusing today and yesterday. And they used that to say, like, if he uncovered the body today, he may confuse that. Great. So it was just, I wish if that would have been a theme about him confusing yesterday and today and the days, I think that may have been made more of an impact. But I mean, again, I think the film was fantastic. I think it was really, you know, just wonderful for so many ways. So I don't want to nitpick here, you know, when it comes to it.
I don't either, because I really enjoyed it though.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I enjoyed
it was
film.
A good choice. Whoever out of the both of you, whoever chose that, I think that was a really good choice.
It's funny. I've been choosing the movies because Larry like the reason we did this is because Larry hasn't really watched a lot of these films, you know, and stuff. So, and I have, because at one point I was on a Hitchcock kick and I was like a kick cock or something like that. I don't know. Whatever. Hitch kick. I don't know. Pretty whatever. I went off and I started watching like as many Hitchcock films as I could. And Trouble with Harry is one of them. I got it at the library and I was like, this is a pretty, like, a lot of times, even though I should not be surprised, I'm always surprised because a lot of these I've never really heard of, you know, as much, you know. Trouble with Harry, I've heard the title, but I didn't know anything about it, you know, or whatever. A lot of people have heard the title.
Some of the reviewers don't share your opinion. It was panned and it became a flop, a box office flop. Hitchcock lost $500,000 of his own money. And he said, well, that's an excessive indulgence on my part. And so anyway, a lot of people scorned it for 60 years. And it just until recently, people are reappreciating it the way it should be.
So, I mean, I don't see. And that's the biggest problem I have is like when critics badmouth or pan these movies, and they probably do it because at that time, maybe this wasn't that kind of, you know, this wasn't that kind of movie, you know, like this wasn't a theater going experience like, you know, a lot of his movies are.
He's known for suspense. So this is kind of an out of the box.
Yeah, this is a comedy, you know,
like it. It's like Sylvester Stallone trying to do comedy.
He's tried to do comedy.
I know, it's the same thing, but people don't like it. Jim Carrey trying to do drama, you know.
Like, I actually like Jim Carrey doing drama, but Sylvester Stallone doing comedy, I can compare that badly too. Like, I don't know, it's weird. You know, when people when famous directors kind of try to step out of their normal comfort zone to do something different, it doesn't get the same response as, you know, I think Mr. and Mrs. Smith did pretty well, and that was his first comedy.
They mentioned that. That's another comedy he did. Also, they mentioned To Catch a Thief. Is that a comedy?
No.
Not
it's a.
Sure why they mentioned that?
Well, it was a little bit different. It's not his normal kind of suspense, but it's you know, it was a pretty good movie. I liked it. It did have comedy in it, but all his films usually have comedy in it.
Yeah, some. But
you
never did any pure comedies. They're always comedy suspense or whatever, but only a couple of them were mentioned as comedies. But anyway, he always had that droll wit, you know, that sense of satire. And some of his prejudices leaked through. He didn't like artists very well either, the modern artists, because he mentioned, remember when they were saying, oh, I saw your name on the painting. And then Sam goes, well, I'm surprised. That should be illegal. It should read my name. It's like, oh, God. People hide their shame, you know, about producing modern art back in the 50s. That was considered kind of taboo. Like, who would do something like that? You know, right? You know, they like realistic art. So, I don't know. It's just some of his attitudes kind of leak through on certain lines, like sexual, society, death. In this particular movie, a lot of things. So, but all directors, I guess, do that, right? They let their opinions be known through their characters. So anyway, I really enjoyed it. There were times when it was kind of tedious, like, okay, we're going to bury him, then we're going to unbury him, and then bury him. And it's like, okay.
That wasn't tedious to me. That was just sort of funny. I don't know why.
It just kind of got it dragged a little bit. But then later on, I thought, you know, it's redeeming itself. It's fine.
Right. Well, because, yeah, at the end, it sets it up where she's like explaining that they buried him, they unburied him, you know, and it's sort of funny. I like the first burial, you know, where he had to like dig that hole and, you know, the captain was really the one doing all the work, you know, basically, which I don't blame him. He's the one who thought he killed them, you know, or whatever. So he should be the one doing all the work, you know.
Well, he discovered that he actually killed a rabbit, you know. He had three bullets, and one was a Coke can, one was a sign, and then I didn't kill him, you know. And I was thinking, this is a great plug for Coca-Cola, because the body was hit over the head with a Coke bottle. He shot a Coke can. I mean, actually mentioned it, and nobody did that back then. So
product placement.
Yeah, absolutely. So very, very, very smartly done.
You know, the other thing that I really liked about this were sort of like just the throwaway comments or just scenes that really weren't connected to the bigger picture, right? So I think one of my favorite parts was whenever Marlo, you know, is talking about Shirley MacLaine's character, and the captain says, "If I was only 2 years younger," I was just a minor comment like that, which had no bearing on the entire film. It's just, it was just really like stuck with me. I was like, wow, that was actually really funny and just random and just unexpected. I thought that was extremely a good execution of humor.
Well, I thought it was pretty funny because that was right. Like you were saying, 2 years younger, this was before I think that Marlo said he was even like interested in her. And so later on he sees him again talking about her. He's like, you are going for her. Okay. You know, right. That's like right. He's kind of giving her the approval. You know, and on top of that, he's going after the other lady.
Waverly, or
Miss Waverly or something. Ivy, I think was her first name, you know, and you know, which they've been talking and they didn't even know each other's like first names. Like they introduce each other at the end of the movie. Like, you know, what's your name? And I'm like, you guys didn't even know this? Like, what? Okay. So big question. All right. I know this is like dissecting Hitchcock or whatever, you know, but my big question is this a small town and how do they not know who each other are? It's like they're all meeting each other for the first time. And yet this town looks pretty small, you know, does not look like there's a huge group of people. All of them know the cop. You know,
right.
How do they not know that woman was married at some point, you know, that now she's widowed, you know, or whatever.
She just moved there.
Okay. So she just moved there. Okay.
A small town. We knew of people. We didn't know them. We didn't really pry that much into their private lives. Some people did, of course, but that's probably why they know of people, but not about them specifically. So maybe that's why.
Maybe I don't know, but that's a good point. Maybe that's what happened. Everybody got love at the end of the movie, you know.
Yeah, they're turning each other on. The guys, Captain and Sam, both were like, "Well, go for it," you know, you might be the first one to cross your threshold, and they Captain with. You know, say stuff about him and Jennifer.
That comment cracked me up. And the other comment that was so fucking rude in a way that Marlo said to Ivy, whatever, Waverly, Miss Waverly or whatever, like when he's talking about her makeup and stuff, and he's like, I would guess you're about what, 50 something, you know, or whatever. That's She's right. like 41, you know, like, wow. Like, what a dick, you know, like he doesn't even apologize. He's just like, oh, well, I can help make you look younger, you know.
Moment. You know, when women ask you questions like that, don't take debate because you're always wrong. And you're like, well, what?
He didn't even care. Like, his character was such a dick in a way, but like he was so likable. Like, so. A likable dick, yeah, no, which is a trait, you know, in films, you know, and that's what I think. Like, if you're gonna make a guy that's, you know, obviously would normally not be likable, you know, like a jerk and a dick, you have to make them somewhat likable and enough. And this dude was completely likable. He was a dick, but you're like, he at least he knows he is. He doesn't care, you know, like, you know,
they're all captivating characters. He created quite a group of them. Interesting. So,
and also, I don't know if you guys know this. Have you guys ever read the book Save the Cat?
No.
It's a screenwriting book. It's my favorite screenwriting book. And basically, in it, there's a thing called a Save the Cat moment, right? And that's where you know that you make the hero likable. And it's usually, that was back in like the 30s where like, you know, 40s, where Jimmy Stewart would go and save a cat from a tree. And all of a sudden everybody would be like, oh, he's so nice. You know, like that would be the moment where everybody would connect with him in some way. I think, honestly, I think John Forsythe's character, we connected with him when he went around and gave everybody else a thing and wasn't even looking out for himself. That was the moment where you were like, okay, this guy's not a terrible guy. Or even, I guess, when he was talking to the captain, like the scene that you were discussing, like where he was talking to the captain, and he's just a very nice guy, just, you know, and he's kind of telling him like, you know, okay, we could hide the guy, but then you're going to be found out somehow or whatever. And they're just having this like nonchalant conversation. And like, it just didn't, it almost didn't feel real in a way, like not in a bad way, but in like, it just felt fantasy. Like no guy would be still painting a dead body, like in public, like that, like where anybody could walk up and see him doing that.
Well, that's a great point, right? And as he pointed out, he's drawing, not painting, right? He put his charcoal on the body's stomach as he was drawing, which I think was actually a really great little touch there. You know, he had the whole thing like right there as he was drawing. But I think, you know, if I was going to, again, nitpick, right? Obviously, it's easy to nitpick 60, 70 years later. But I had a little bit of issue with the negative comments he was making about Jerry Mather's character, right? He would say like it was kind of played off as kind of fun, right? He'd be like making a negative comment about him and saying like, you know, especially whenever Jerry, what's the kid's name again in the movie? Jerry Mather?
I think it was Arnie. Like
Arnie, right? Like in the end, he was like, he just made a comment about like, oh, get out of here, whatever. And it was just, but it wasn't balanced with anything, right? It was just always like this negative caustic comments toward Arnie. And I know, like I said, I don't want to dig too deep because the whole thing was all sort of surreal, but that's the only comment I had about his character. Like I get like that he was, I love the save the cat moment you talked about, Jonathan. I think that's a great call out, but I think that he was so negative toward Arnie that it just, to me, it was distracting a little bit.
I don't know, because he did like, ask what Arnie would like, you know, he'd like a chemical set. He did. There were times where he was like saying, I think I would be a great dad for Arnie, you know, that kind of thing too, you know, and everything. So he did love the kid or whatever. I have like some kind of, but I mean, he was obviously in love with the woman, you know, and he says something like that to the kid. He talked about how beautiful his mother was.
Right. He did.
Yes. And stuff. And I was just like, that's a little weird. Like if I were a kid who did not have a dad at that particular moment, I would not like I'd be a little bit more protective of my mom, you know?
It was pretty transparent. He was after the woman. And he even mentioned it one time, get away, you little creep. And he said, and then he changed his
tune. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Kind of slipped,
you're right, he did kind of come off weird. Like his character kind of came off as like, you can't, I guess you couldn't really trust him that much, you know, like which way is he gonna go, right?
That's right. I mean, again, you know, if you're gonna sit there and assess all of the dialogue in the movie, it, you know, it doesn't really hold up to how connected to reality is it, so I don't want to necessarily nitpick on that specific comments against Arnie.
We're going to suspend our disbelief.
That's right. I'll go back to that.
Well, interestingly enough, the writer of it is John Michael Hayes, who did a ton of Hitchcock movies, including To Catch a Thief, which we talked about earlier, Rear Window. Let's see. He had done The Man Who Knew Too Much, the remake. I think I saw one more. Than he did of him. No, I guess not. I think that was it. I think the last one he did was The Man Who Knew Too Much. He also did Iron Will. Nice. I like that movie. So he unfortunately passed away in 2008 at the age of 89. So, you know, he lived a pretty good life and did a lot of really good movies. So I really liked this one. A lot of people love Rear Window, and I'm not a huge fan of that one as much. It took me a long time to actually sit through the whole thing of it, because to me it was just really, really boring, you know? It once again, it goes to that voyeur thing of like watching whatever, and maybe that's why Hitchcock made it. I don't know. But this movie was a lot more fun to me. And this isn't as famous as that movie. That movie is godly, way more, like everybody calls that like one of the one of the, like everybody's six favorite or something, you know, like, you know, whatnot. It wouldn't be my favorite up there, but it would mean it would be up there in my top 20 maybe, but not my top 10, you know, even. So I think that's because I've been watching so many more movies of his that a lot of people don't give these ones credit, you know, because they only talk about Psycho or Rear Window or North by Northwest or Vertigo. Vertigo gets a lot of, you know, another Birds. One I think is okay. Right. The Birds, you know, those, and this, that's why I wanted to start this show really and continue to do it. And only one, you know, one movie out of the whole seasons, we will, you know, we would bring up like a famous one, you know, or whatever. But the rest, I want to explore all the ones that people, you know, don't talk about, you know, or whatever. And this is definitely one that I think more people should see. Now, Mark, had you seen it before, you said?
You know, a long, long time ago, I really appreciated watching it again and really intently watching it, knowing that we're going to talk about it. So it gave me a huge appreciation for it.
Yeah, definitely. And Larry, you had never seen it.
I had never seen it. So I watched this one twice. And one thing I noticed the second time, you know, you pick up things and gloss over the first time. Did you notice the marijuana leaves on the lampshade? There's an hour and a half in. It was actual marijuana leaves. I thought, this is the 50s. But
nice.
But I wanted to talk real quick about one of the things that maybe we didn't discuss. Like, he wanted Grace Kelly for this, but she wasn't available. So he had to choose a chorus girl. And Shirley MacLaine had never been in a movie in her life, but he was endeared with her. And they started eating together, you know, for dinner. And the studio heads were concerned that Shirley was gaining weight. They put her on a diet because she was noticeable throughout the film, getting a little heavier. And then Hitch discovered Jerry Mathers, and then 2 years later, but you already know about that. Funeral March of the Marionette was included in the score and then rejected. And then later used for Alfred Hitchcock Presents. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
We did not discuss the score yet. And I do want to discuss that real quick because that was done by Bernard Herrmann, who is most famous for doing the Psycho score, I think, you know, but he's worked with like Brian De Palma, and Brian De Palma specifically picked him because of Psycho. But if you, apparently Hitchcock, this is Hitchcock's favorite score of all his movies. I mean, that's what it says on IMDb. I don't know if that's, you know, I've never heard it from the horse's mouth himself. Like, he hasn't ever actually said it. By the way, I've never understood that expression, the horse's mouth. Like, seriously, like, horses don't, you know, whatever. Yeah. I don't know who came up with that, but whatever. But yeah, the Bernard Herrmann did it, and he was amazing. He did, if you guys watch Kill Bill, they took a little score from it. And have you guys seen Kill Bill? Have you seen Volume 2? Where, oh, I think it was it Volume 2 or Volume 1?
I saw 1.
It was 1. It was Volume 1. And it was where Daryl Hannah is walking up into the hospital to go get her, to go get Uma Thurman. And as she's walking up, she hears, like, there you hear this, like, tune, you know, like a whistle and stuff. That was Bernard Herrmann. So Tarantino loved a movie called Twisted Nerve, and that was the tune from that and everything. Bernard Herrmann is amazing, and made some great, you know, themes. And this was like, when I listened to it, I was like, oh my god, this is like, I wanted to find out who made the score, you know, because I was just like, this is really freaking good. What did you guys think of it?
Yeah, I you know what stuck out to me, of course, whenever they would show the different characters, sometimes they really associated different scores with each one, right? Yeah. Whether it was the sheriff or Arnie or whatever, I really liked that. And then there was this whimsical approach to a lot of the score, but then there was always this underlying, you know, minor
like suspense.
I thought was kind of cool.
I thought it got dark at times in the score, and I'm like, oh my God, what's going to happen? But like, it's usually when nothing's, you know, when nothing necessarily is going on, that's too, right. it does it. And it just gives you this like feeling of like, you know, I don't know what's next, you know?
Yeah.
And
it's very effective for that reason.
Exactly.
Suspense and the drama of it.
Yeah. So I just loved it. I always adore his music. And I adore Hitchcock's picking of these things, you know, because you can tell Hitchcock's very precise about everything, you know. You look at all the shots, they're all lined up perfectly. You know, if there's something that's in like the background, it's supposed to be there exactly that way or whatever. And like that scene where he's painting the ground and then he just finally notices that there's feet in the way. And he's like, he comes and he looks and everything. And then he walks up and he's like, hey, you're in my way. You're in my shot, you know, or whatever. Yeah, right.
That's right.
Yeah, wake up. Oh, okay. Well, he's dead, you know, which just the whole time, every character is just like, yeah, the character's dead. Oh, well, you know,
the attention to detail is remarkable. And I just noticed something. It wasn't Miss Waverly, it was Miss Gravely. So he put that in there. Gravely. It's like little things like that. You have to really dig for it.
Well, I wonder if a lot of that was the book. There was an actual book. This is based on a book.
Yeah.
And Hitchcock actually bought the book, the rights himself, you know, out of his own pocket. That's why he was like, I think you said earlier, Larry, that he was out of $500,000 or whatever, you know, or something. That was his own money, you know. And he's only done that a couple times. Normally it's the studios that pay for it, like Universal or somebody pays for it. This and Psycho were about like the biggest ones, and both were kind of, I think, were kind of bombs, you know, at the time and everything. Psycho got more of a cult following, like, you know, but this one was definitely not, you know, not the biggest hit, and I feel like it's definitely should be.
He bought the rights to this one and four other ones and left them to his daughter Patricia, who then, you know, released them later after his death. One was Vertigo, Man Who Knew Too Much, Rope, and Rear Window were the other four.
You mean, how do you mean release them? So now
he bought them and he wouldn't release them for some strange reason until after he died. I mean, they were released at first, and then he bought the rights and held back for some reason, some odd reason, and only left them to his daughter to do what she wanted. And then, of course, she did circulate them.
Well, she did, because I think she does a lot of the documentary stuff where she'll be behind the scenes talking about, like, this is what my father did and all that stuff. And I love that. I love seeing her. Don't know if she's still around or not. I think she is. If she is, God bless her soul, because, you know, she was in a ton of, like, she was in Strangers on Trade and tons of movies that, speaking of which, that'll be our next month's movie, Strangers on a Train. Just throwing that out there because I'm really excited about that one again. It's a classic, just like this one is. Like, this one should be viewed up there. You know, people should watch this to learn more about film, you know, I believe. But I think we're getting about that time where it's been about an hour. Is there anything, Larry, that you needed to make sure you get across that you wanted to point out?
They said to sum up the movie, it's when the lady, was it Miss Gravely or the other woman who meets Captain for the first time? And she says, what seems to be the trouble, Captain? And they said that summed up the entire movie. The cavalier attitude towards something so horrific as a dead body, somebody's dragging it. Said, what seems to be the trouble, Captain? So, you know, it kind of sums up the whole attitude of the movie about the disrespect that's a dead Alvin. But
I agree.
He was guilty. But also, you know, Hitchcock had such a big heart. He had the world premiere of the movie in Vermont, some place called Bar Vermont. And he did a 3-minute Vermont promotional video before the film. So he really liked the small towns in Vermont, away from Hollywood. He tried to get away from Hollywood as much as possible. And he only went back because they had some problems with the fall foliage. They had to glue leaves on the trees. But Jim, it was raining so much, and then they couldn't hear the voices because of the sound of the rain on the roof. So they had to go back to a studio in LA. And so it was shot in late September. And I guess it was an early fall, and all of the leaves fell off the tree. So, you know, little bits like that are kind of interesting. But
yeah, that's interesting because Halloween, I don't even think that was actually filmed in the fall. But I think that was filmed in like summer, and they had to actually put paint like leaves, and then they had to put them up. And then I heard a funny story where that PJ Souls talked about where, she was, she was told to like run up and grab them, you know, like collect the leaves, like when they're leaving, you know, by the, Deborah Hill, the producer. Yeah. That's an indie thing, you know, right there. But, which is funny because Hitchcock and John Carpenter, like John Carpenter loved Hitchcock so much, you know. But I just want to say thank you once again. Thank you, Mark, for coming on the show and everything and giving your insights. Was there anything that, like, overall did you want to say? Or
yeah, I think, you know, Larry introduced it, right? I think, you know, an unsung hero in all this is the background in New England. You know, I live in Pittsburgh, so I'm kind of a little bit closer to New England than I think both of you. Although, Jonathan, not that much closer at the moment than where you live in Virginia. Yeah. But, like, you know, I'm a big fan of New England. I think that this is an amazing film in the way that it just sort of really framed a lot of the foliage and just the whole, you know, New England small town. And it's interesting, you know, as you called out John Carpenter's Halloween, and it was supposed to be set in Haddonfield, Illinois, right? And in some of the scenes, you can see some of these palm trees and, you know, and it's like, hey, wait a second, is that really growing in Illinois in Halloween, right?
Right.
So, yeah. So, you know, my background, obviously, in addition to behavioral health, I'm very much involved with biology. So I'm constantly always looking at plants and movies to say, is that really something that grows in that zone there or not? So I think it was, I think in this particular film of Hitchcock's, he did an amazing job of highlighting just the landscape of New England. And I really, really appreciated that additional element of this film. So I just want to, so Larry, thanks for introducing that. And I think that was another thing that I think should be noteworthy, and especially in the vibrant technicolors that they used in the film.
Yeah, it was very beautiful. Beautifully shot. And I mean, I kept just staring at the leaves and the scenery, you know. Like, I honestly think if he just made the movie about the scenery, I would have even watched it because it was just so fucking beautiful the whole time. Yeah. So it was great. Like, I think Larry pointed out some slow bits, you know, with the burying and the unburying and everything. And still, for some reason, I think because of the scenery and the other stuff, I was still so enthralled with it that it just, some of the slow bits didn't even bother me, you know. Like, I get it. Like, I see that. I can see where, you know, where people say that, but I don't know.
Violated the rule of three. You know, after three times, it gets a little old.
Yeah, it's a little too. It's good, like
point. Four, five, or six. Anyway.
You know, they just keep digging, right?
Yeah, it's terrible. But, yeah, I agree. The scene was very distracting. It's hard to focus on the acting.
Well, I mean, and most of it was dialogue, so that was a great thing. Is a lot of times you just can listen to it, you know, and stuff. And I just enjoyed it. It was almost like a play a little bit, you know.
Yeah, great point.
And I really enjoyed that. And I enjoyed that it took place basically in one day, you know, because, you know, like after a while, you start forgetting it's just all one day. And then you're like, oh, crap, you know, all this happened in one night, one day. Like,
I was thinking it was more than one day. And I thought, you know, that body should be covered with maggots by now.
No.
It was.
All right. Well, we will be back next week with Strangers on a Train, which I'm really excited. I'm going to buy that on Blu-ray again. So I'm really excited just to see that. And I know, Larry, have you seen it before?
I may have. I look forward to viewing it again.
Mark, had you ever seen that one?
I never have, actually. I don't think so.
Well, we'll definitely have you back on the show soon enough. We really like listening to your insights on everything.
I would.
Well, yeah. I appreciate being on the show. And Jonathan, I appreciate just the amount of work that you do with these different podcasts and just the variety. And thanks for including me in these conversations. I'm very humbled to be part of them.
Yeah, I almost didn't think we'd be able to do it. We had some lightning and thunder just a few minutes, like right before the show. And I was like, oh, shit. And we weren't able to do the show yesterday, unfortunately, because just little things just popped up and we weren't able to do it. So we had to postpone it till like next week. But so I was like, oh, man, please don't let me just not be able to do a pod. Like I was missing my computer and I was the biggest thing I was missing was the podcast, honestly. And so like I just this is like my heart and soul, you know, I love doing them. This is my passion. So I'm very happy to have you guys here. You'll definitely be welcome back. Also, if you guys want to check out Mark's show, Brain Burrow, how can they check that out?
Yeah, thanks for that little plug there, Jonathan. I mean, it's a, you know, if you just go to Brain Burrow, all one word, BRAINBURROW.com, you can get links to both the podcast and the vidcast. So thanks for that plug. It's a good way to connect to all of it.
Or you can also listen to repeats. Oh,
yes, that is correct.
Yes, we have repeats on our channels on the Indie Film Cafe Network. So we love doing that. And we've been, I guess, you know, we've got almost 12 episodes or something like that, or 10 episodes.
Yeah, I appreciate the weekly uploads out there. So thank you, Jonathan, for that.
Yeah, we want to get more shout outs to there and try to get more listeners because that's, you know, what we enjoy here. Your show is a lot of fun and enjoyable and really like thought provoking. So we really appreciate you.
There's nothing out there like it. So spread the word.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both. And Larry, of course, you know, since you appeared on the show, Larry, people can watch you and as you dig deep with your life and as well. So I think that was very insightful and powerful.
Don't watch that one, please. Very revealing.
If you ever interview me, I better be on a couch when I'm doing that.
Right.
You know,
since Jonathan, we got season 2 coming up, so we can definitely have you on there. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much. If you guys could stay on real quick and everything, but everybody else, tune in next month for a whole new episode and enjoy. Have a good one.
Sure.
Bye.